Hey everyone, Jeremy here. Welcome back to the Towards Data Science podcast. And today we are talking about the global side of the AI safety picture with one of the co-founders of the Future Society, Nicolas Miai. Now, Nicolas himself is a globally recognized expert on AI and AI policy. He's advised a whole bunch of really important international bodies, including the Global Partnership on AI, which we'll talk about a fair bit in this conversation. Nicolas' approach and the approach of the Future Society more generally are actually quite interesting and unique, and they're focused on finding consensus not only between groups of people who worry about short-term AI risks versus long-term AI risks, but also between countries around the world that see AI quite differently. As you'll see during our conversation, I think that's just a really important area to be working on, and it leads to a lot of interesting downstream discussion. So I hope you enjoyed this conversation, and I'll get out of the way and let it start. All right. Well, Nico, thanks so much for joining me for the podcast.
Thanks a lot, Jeremy, and good morning to all the joggers that might be listening to us as they are taking their run in the morning or in the evening around the world. And congrats for all the podcast series and all the great work you're doing. And thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Actually, to Nico's comment, we were just talking about how the vast majority of people who listen to this podcast really do listen to it rather than watch it. So it's kind of nice because if I'm having a bad hair day, you know, I can get away with a lot here. But Nico, you are doing some really interesting work at the Future Society. You're one of the co-founders of the Future Society. One of the things I find really interesting, especially for highly capable people who have, you know, fairly technical and sophisticated backgrounds, you know, when you choose to dedicate your time to an initiative like the Future Society, something that's very forward-looking, it's not like you're raking in piles of cash or anything like that. You're doing this for a reason. I'd love to understand what brought you to this sort of forward-looking set of concerns. Why the specific concerns about the future that you have, and what are those concerns?
Well, you're right to point to this and frame it as public service. I have very much impression with my team, and have the honor and privilege of being the president as well as the founder of the Future Society, and I co-founded it with other people. And we see this as a form of public service. We see ourselves as an actor of the emerging global civil society sector. Now, why we do that, and why we have decided to call ourselves the Future Society, which is a big lofty name that serves also as a mission, that serves also as a claim, because it's about nothing less but this, nothing less but trying to invent the society of the future that we want, nothing less but trying to reconcile in practice, align in practice, the ecological transition and the digital transition spearheaded with AI, and align them in a way that does not sacrifice, but actually upholds the best for more values in terms of freedom, or values in terms of democracy and self-governance, and our values in terms of solidarity and equality. Doing that in practice is not as easy as it sounds, because, well, AI can be framed as a general purpose technology. And let's state it, it has profound consequences and implications in terms of national security and international security, or lack thereof, and a redistribution. It's not falling out from the sky. It is really emerging from the ground, and the ground is that of the digital revolution. And as such, it is reinventing the way in which we work, live, socialize, and in many ways, it is disrupting some of our most fundamental social contracts, pushing forward notions of consumers and our identities as consumers, and questioning our identities as citizens, centralizing power at the top and at the center. So why do we do that, and why we focus on AI governance? Well, there is also a sense of pragmatism versus timing. There are big policy decisions being taken right now. So for us to act as an independent, evidence-based, small, very much underfunded, but still active global think and do tank, we believe is needed now. You know, in other words, there is a policy window around AI, but around other things underpinned by the digital revolution. Neurotechnologies, cryptocurrencies. So our very small global AI think and do tank, we think is needed. And maybe a few differentiators on how we try and do things a bit different. Well, the first one is that, in our opinion, the how and the what of whatever and however we do and decide things are inextricably connected. You cannot think over a policy question and not think as to how you are going to impact it, the how and the what. And that means that we also have started to develop our own machine learning based tool to try and impact policy decisions. One example, is a project called AI Against Modern Slavery, where we work to develop a machine learning-based tool using existing models to help expedite the review and compliance of modern slavery statement that corporations have to file every year. And the goal is, okay, to enhance the accountability of governments and businesses, but also to try and usher a new generation of AI-ready, AI-capable, AI-powered public policies and legislations. But I'd say that our mandate is definitely beyond AI. And from our observations, we want, and that's why we're called the Future Society, because we also want to be looking at gene editing, neurotechnologies. There is right now momentum on AI, and it's important to impact this this moment of to have an impact on this momentum.
Well, I find it really interesting that you highlight AI against modern slavery on the one hand, and then there's also a bunch of other AI policies that address the use of AI by companies and corporations and countries. It sort of highlights what you were saying, AI being a dual-use technology. On the one hand, you know, it's great. It can be applied to a whole bunch of social good. It can unlock just generally great use cases. But in the same way that GPT-3, for example, might be able to do great text summarization or language translation, it might also help people carry out better phishing attacks and things like that. So there's always like kind of two sides to this coin.
It's very important. Another key tenet of our approach is that the opportunities and the challenges of AI are inextricably and irremediably connected. And we stand, and our mission is to help advance the responsible adoption of AI and other emerging tech for the benefit of humanity, because we think, and that's an important, in a way, principle of action, we think that we do need AI, and we are going to need AI to help solve the global challenges that we confront, including climate change, for example, and help usher a new era of human flourishing and human evolution. But we are cautiously techno-optimistic, but worried about the level of collective wisdom that our species and its manifestation through governance institutions exhibit right now to be able to capture the benefits while minimizing the downsides and dealing with the risks. That's a question of balance, or rather imbalances.
Actually, that's its own fascinating topic. And it maps onto some more technical conversations that we've had on the podcast with people who focus on like technical AI alignment issues, where there's this big open debate right now about whether, for example, we want to build AI capabilities and then kind of like correct safety issues as they arise, or do we need safety to reach really far ahead and then like try to anticipate where the technology is going? Increasingly, it seems like people are saying, look, we just can't do anything with this safety-wise until we build the capabilities. These things have to come in tandem. They have to be in lockstep. Sort of like what you're suggesting here, the technology has to assist with the safety and the fairness.
Well, I partly disagree in the sense that I believe in the need for what we call disentangled research. There is value in a lot of value in what people like Miri are doing, for example.
Hey everyone, it's Jeremy. I just wanted to jump in here and provide a little bit more context on the organization Nico just mentioned, since I'm guessing it'll be new to at least some of you. MIRI is the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, and they're really the first research team ever dedicated to addressing potential catastrophic risks from AI. MIRI was founded back in 2000, and their founder, Eliezer Yudkowsky, was one of the early pioneers of AI-related existential risk research. He also happens to write some of the best Harry Potter fan fiction you'll ever find. I'm dead serious about this. Google it and you'll thank me later.
There is value in a lot of value in what people like Miri are doing, for example, trying to develop AI safety protocols and pathways way ahead of AGI. I think there is a lot of value in that. And I want to recognize what they do, because it's never easy to know and to do research on something that does not yet exist. Mm-hmm. You know, it drives everyone crazy. It embeds a schizophrenic dynamics. So they have to be recognized, because it's a lonely work, but it has to be done. Why? Because part of the AI safety pathways will emerge from dealing well with AI ethics. The world of tomorrow will emerge from the world of today, but not exclusively. We have been strategically surprised in the past. Mm. The case of the Manhattan Project is a case in point. So there is value in baking at the core of what our community, the AI development and adoption community, is, ideas and pathways to try and project, do the effort of projecting into the unknown. I think that's very valuable. And part of what we need to do is reconcile these approaches. And we are part of a community that tries and do that. So so that's why I say I only partly disagree with what you say, and I want to recognize the need for disentangled research besides other pathways where you try and align the ultra short, if not immediate, short, mid, long and ultra long term. That's
I completely agree. I mean, I think so. I suppose what I might have meant, to put it maybe more correctly, there is a portfolio approach on AI safety. There's a portfolio approach on AI policy where, as you say, a variety of different time windows need to be factored in. We have to make sure that we're incrementing correctly, but also that we're projecting correctly. Organizations like Miri are really important for the latter. And then this kind of like gradual escalation of safeties and capabilities research is another component of that almost risk portfolio that we need to be developing. By the way, one of the most remarkable things, I think, at least to me, that you just said there was, it is so rare for me to hear an AI policy person or somebody who focuses on AI policy talk about Miri, talk about an organization that most people, like, usually have to be in this technical niche to know what Miri is. I'd love to understand, like, was Miri part of your, and Eliezer Yudkowsky's work, all that stuff, was that part of your journey to discovering the AI safety space? Or is that something that you've discovered along the way? Like, I'm really curious about how you came to this this area.
Well, of course, it was part of my journey. I was born and raised in Paris, in France, but I spent 10 years in India. So I've been exposed, and I worked in industry. So I've been exposed to the huge potential of algorithmic correlation to help advance questions of development and access to basic services at scale. India is 1 billion people. When India decides to launch a DAR project to establish a biometric-based, meaning algorithmic correlation-based, central identity database to fuel its social programs, you know this will have a global impact on development and on AI. And so at that point, I realized that there was a growing gap between the urgency of development and the need to plan the long run in terms of the potential second, third, and fourth order consequences of the AI and algorithmic correlation revolution. And because of that willingness to reconcile, in a way, the universal, the ultra long term, the cosmos with the immediate, I have, from the get-go, decided that it would be one of our mission to try and reconcile these ultra long-term challenges with the ultra short-term. Because if we don't do that, we'll have neither of the two. Because we need to also respect the urgency of development. And the fact that a lot of organizations, a lot of people still today have a need for access to basic services of healthcare, transportation, banking, and so much others. And this thirst for algorithmic correlation needs to be quenched, but quenched in a way that is both ethical to reconcile this end of the day with the end of the month, fairness, privacy, and also paving the way for a reconciliation of the, if you allow, end of the world. This question of catastrophic, if not existential. So this question of reconciling this ultra long to ultra short term in a way that reconciles so the global north, Yudkowsky and all the great people working at Miri operate out of California. They don't operate out of India. There are a lot of great Indian researchers and super capable and if not genius Indian researchers in the Silicon Valley. But the fact of the matter is that a lot of this AI safety perspective still emerges from California, from Oxbridge, from Paris, not so much from the global south. And so this effort of reconciliation of this end of the day, end of the month, end of the world, in my view, is especially important to bake concerns of AI safety in the quest for AI development, as much as in the quest for AI ethics and vice versa. It's not easy because these communities come at the problem with very different perspectives and very different epistemological perspectives and worldviews. So it's hard. And at times, you know, one risk being considered as a lightning rod because you try and bring people together. But one of our mission is to try and do just that around scientific processes. The idea that we researched and put forward for an IPCC for AI, which then became the Global Partnership on AI, was not our idea, but I can say that we have a bit of a significant influence in its pathway from the research to the deployment, initially aimed at doing just that. We need to come together as a community around a robust knowledge creation process. It is called science. Science is a process to create knowledge, robust knowledge, and replicate that knowledge and the effect of the knowledge we have on the world. We have to come together to create a solid base of matter of fact, built from science, that informs our collective understanding of what do we mean by AI. There is still no consensus on that. As a complex socio-technical system, we defer a lot as to what we mean by AI. Number one. Number two, what are its dynamics on the short, mid, and long term? The question of AGI remains highly contentious. there's deep still in our AI community disagreement over the possibility and the time frame of the possible emergence of a human capable AI and the consequences. So definition, dynamics, and consequences. When you and I, Jeremy, go out today virtually and we look up in the sky, will we agree that the sky is blue today? We will. But we won't agree today as to, or we may not agree today, as to what AI is and its dynamics and its consequences. Mm-hmm. So this, the idea of an IPCC for AI was there to create the foundations, to lay down the foundations over time, to come together and create a solid base of matter of fact globally to inform policy debate. We don't need to agree on all the social contracts, but can we agree on the fact that the sky is blue and that the sun appears to our eyes as yellow today?
So I think to listeners who maybe are following AGI a little bit less closely, if this is closer to an introductory conversation for you, I think one thing that might run by you or get past you, as it did for me back in the day, is just like how important this idea is of the disagreement between people who worry about short-term AI risk and people who worry about long-term AI risk. It's very common to hear people say, we need to be focused exclusively on one and not on the other. There's like an active, there are papers that have been published in the AI safety community talking about how this seems to be like an impasse, trying to find different ways to kind of reconcile these things. It's really rare to have somebody, like an organization focused on reconciling those two perspectives. I think that's actually one of the coolest things about what you're doing here. Not only, I mean, you're doing it along the time axis. You're trying to say, okay, long-termists and short-termists, let's bring it together on this. But you're
time
also,
space.
Time, I was going to say,
physics tells us time and space are the same thing. So why don't we start implementing that reconciliation in policy? It's not time, it's space-time. So it's north, south, east, west, short, immediate, mid, and long, and ultra-long. Yes, it's hard to do. Yes, we're going to break our brain on this. Yes, I agree. But it's either we do that or we expose ourselves to potentially catastrophic risk on the long term. And that's very important. And another of, so why governance? Why governance? Why focus a lot on policy and the state as mm-hmm. as a manifestation mm-hmm. of a human identity and a processes to influence and govern human lives?
Yeah, I think a lot of people wonder about that because companies right now dominate AI research and it's
well,
like...
Do they? Do they? Mm. When you look at the figures, of course they do now, but come on. Don't you believe that a lot of what was made possible for Google, Amazon, OpenAI, I would say, is the result of massive, massive government investment. I would argue even that it's only taxes, which only governments can mobilize. In other words, the fact of having your grandkids who are not even born start paying today for long-term patient high-risk capital that enables this kind of a very deep techno-scientific revolution, not necessarily the innovation. The private sector is really good at taking techno-scientific revolution into innovations. Yes, these lines are blurred. And indeed, I don't disagree with the fact that now these multinationals, these oligopolistic multinationals are investing at par with many governments. I don't disagree with that. But I want to recognize the fact that defense policy, innovation policy, healthcare policy through their institutions such as DARPA, NSF, NIH, are and will continue to play a huge role. And therefore, citizens should and have in a way a say in the foundations of these techno-scientific revolutions. And let's take an example of today, OpenAI. What has happened to OpenAI over the past 2 years? Well, massive capital infusion from private corporations whom we know have also big and received big, you know, investment from governments. It has been a cause of worry for some in our community that, you know, Microsoft has invested $1 billion in OpenAI, and at the same time, Microsoft has received a significant investment from the Department of Defense through the JEDI contract. And I don't want to oversimplify, it's more complex than that, but I just want to say that even in that case, to grow its model and output a model with more impact, you know, the investment of government is and remains very important. And where did all these researchers that went to OpenAI come from initially? And I would venture to say that a lot of policy support for education and a lot of policy support for best universities was at play. So that's why we tend to oppose and oversimplify the role of the private versus the role of the public. It is my individual stance, not necessarily the stance of the future society, that government through research and support to research funded by taxes, and look at what happened yesterday in the US, the Biden recovery plan, over almost $2 trillion US. Tell me, which company is capable of laying that on the table? Not all of that will go to research, we know, but this ability to mobilize long-term, patient, high-risk capital, you know, over time in large numbers is still in many ways the realm of the government, justified by many good and not so good ideas, including national security. We support national security. But when national security is used as a tool for expansion, it can also be a problem. President Eisenhower, upon leaving office, you know, in his farewell to the nation, as a general himself, warned the nation over what he framed as the military-industrial complex. So we should not overemphasize and go into conspiracy theory. I don't believe in that. But even if the president in his farewell address mentioned that, we need to pay attention to all the great benefits. We went to the moon with that. And we will go to Mars with government support. Where would SpaceX be without NASA support? Let's be honest.
Yeah, they're an interesting series of questions for sure. And I think disentangling the public and private thing is highly non-trivial. I think it's also the case, viewed through another lens, that there are areas of AI safety research that private companies are not going to be incentivized to work on. Like, I'm thinking here especially of like the alignment problem, right? Right now, the work that MIRI is doing, I think, is a great example. No one at MIRI is making the argument that by doing the research they're doing, they're going to accelerate economic development at any point in the next like 5 years or something like that. They're not building new tools, not helping new companies launch. What they're really fundamentally doing is trying to avert a catastrophe. This has the profile, the risk profile of something like buying insurance. And the people who are going to be funding this are not companies that are looking to optimize shareholder value. They're going to be, you know, people who can transcend this sort of like a tragedy of the commons. I mean, ultimately, that's what this is. There's a risk that everybody bears.
In part, in my view, it's a tragedy of the commons. Over space-time, over a community that is not fully aware of itself, which is called the humanity, so to speak. But if we claim the global, if we claim the species, then we have to be careful as to who claims it. That's why we at TFS, the Future Society, puts enormous emphasis on inclusion and civic engagement. Because the moment we claim that we are doing something for humanity, we have to be careful as to who are we to make that claim and how, in a way, representative we are. And representativeness is not only a question of legitimacy, it's a question of blind spots. I grew up in Paris. I did not grow up in Kenya. I don't have the same understanding of this reality over there. But I say Kenya because we know that Africa is going through a demographic boom. And a lot of the insurance policies we're developing today are for them in a way. That's why this question of reconciling the North and the South, East and West is very important. But we have to do that, in my view, in a way that does not paralyze action. That's why I very much support the work of MIRI. I very much support the work of AI Safety because it has to be done. I'm just saying that, and they're aware of it, that it has to be done in a more representative way. Even, and I would say, maybe they won't agree with that, but even if we are looking at disentangled research, which is ultra long-term. Because the way in which we look at ultra long-term is not the same if we come from a philosophical tradition of, Ashkenazi European, secular American, or Buddhist, or African, with or without any given epistemological, philosophical, and even spiritual tradition. These, we need to be humble. These traditions have an impact on us, whether we like it or not. So we need to consider them in a way and try and build diversity and inclusion.
So I'd love to prod at that, because that to me seems like one of the biggest challenges we face today is you have this massively impactful technology. And I mean, it seems clear that with the way GPT-3 has shown us, you know, AI can just grow by leaps and bounds every couple of months. Like, we're going to be surprised, as you say, by new technological advances. Power starts to get centralized in the hands of the people who have, you know, so on and so forth. But if we can't agree, like, it seems like everybody will have a different lens through which they're seeing AI. Some countries can't afford to worry about safety because, like, they're just trying to lift themselves up right now. Like, developing economies cannot put resources towards safety. To them, AI... and maybe you'll disagree, actually. I won't.
Okay. It's a reconciliation problem. That's why it's so important to build capacity in the global south for the responsible adoption of AI and governance of AI, to have them part of the conversation on global AI ethics, local AI ethics, to have them part of the conversation on AI adoption so that they can share the benefits, they can have control. It will never be perfect control. But we are at a stage today where, you know, it can be labeled or framed as cyber colonialism. And when I say cyber colonialism, I'm not talking US and Kenya, I'm talking France and the US. France today is a digital colony of the US. So if it's that level of power imbalances between two G7 countries, what will it be between Europe and Africa, between the US and Africa? And that's therefore imperative that we help, and not help, empower them in building a capacity for the responsible adoption of AI to avert that, to reconcile that. Because otherwise, we accelerate the race dynamics. Because if you tell someone, either you wake up or you are going to be potentially enslaved to the vision and the identity of someone, you know, someone with pride and willingness to defend her or his identity will react. And that reaction will translate into a potential race. Some would say that the capacity in Africa is so small that there is not much risk and we should focus only on the US and China. And I would say, well, no, we need to triangulate. Where is the big market of tomorrow? Where are these needs that need to be satisfied? So where is, in a way, the potential battleground between Europe, China, and the US? Well, potentially Africa, to oversimplify. That's why harnessing AI for development, and that's one of our mission at TFS. We work a lot on that. We are right now finishing a project with the government of Rwanda to help Rwanda develop its national AI strategy and implementation plan to try and create a pathway to accelerate African empowerment through the responsible adoption of AI. It's very important. It's very important for AI safety, I'm arguing.
That's really interesting, because I think I see things a little bit differently on that score. I'd be really curious about your thoughts on this. So in the 90s, there was this policy with respect to China in particular, where, you know, economic liberalism will lead to political liberalism. We thought that by, you know, setting up trade agreements that were favorable, generous, and kind to China, that ultimately we would have a global partner. And unfortunately, the relationship there has become adversarial. Including in AI, where now a lot of people in the AI safety and AI policy community are explicitly concerned about the US-China rivalry as one of the main drivers of international instability and AI dissafety. So I guess the idea of multipolarity, that you might have, you know, not just a US-China or competition, but potentially other players who are equally as capable when it comes to AI, might be argued to have a destabilizing effect. At least my intuition takes me in that direction. So while I'm certainly very I very much like the argument that, look, everybody kind of needs a seat at the table, it isn't right to just have a set of ideas that are developed in Shanghai or Silicon Valley dominate the world. We need, yeah.
Hold on. So I come from, before working in industry, I worked for the Ministry of Defense. Okay, and I was entrusted with a small element of the French military nuclear policy, which was to try and envisage nuclear deterrence post 9/11. Well, it was a work of analyst and study. And I very much see, so this notion of offense, defense, strategic balance, stability comes a lot with very good reasons from the nuclear paradigm. And we should not forget the nuclear strategic paradigm, because it's an existential policy paradigm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I want to draw at least a few differences between this paradigm and what we're facing. The nuclear paradigm was a fundamental paradigm, which could be represented in a simplistic way through the following bargain. There are risks associated, but there are rewards in the form of access to cheap energy. You have to surrender your ability to develop military nuclear power, and we will give you access to civilian nuclear power, which decreases the cost of access to mass energy. And energy has a big impact on our lives, but the way in which it was intermediated made that bargain quite binary and quite distant to most of people, except in the case, and we're celebrating the anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear catastrophe, except in certain cases, which I don't want to turn a blind eye to. Let's face the reality too. But the bargain that AI as a general purpose technology offers on us, in my view, goes way beyond that. As I said in introduction, AI reinvents the way in which we live, work, and socialize in a way that potentially rewire our brains even. So that's why this question of, well, we'll decide for you, US and China, and you can sit there, don't worry, the positive externality of stability will be peace for you. But people see that their very identities are affected by this bargain. Mm-hmm. And they want to have a seat at the table, because it's about living, working in socializing in a way which is very direct and not distant. As nuclear had that influence, of course, energy, life, death, but no, it's much richer. AI is all pervasive, really all pervasive.
There's something more fundamentally, it's fundamentally threatening in a way to somebody having AI dominance over you rather than having nuclear dominance. Nuclear dominance is kind of like, the country can threaten you, they can tell you to do whatever. I guess there's something more insidious about AI, where you use deep, Twitter.
Totally. Yeah. It's much deeper. It's not I will destroy or let you live. It's I will really reinvent the social contracts. It's very deep. Influence your thoughts, influence who you think you are, influence the redistribution mechanisms of your country, influence the consuming patterns, influence production patterns. It's deep. It's not binary. And I wouldn't say that nuclear is shallow. It's not shallow, mind you, but of course. But it's in my view, not as deep in terms of the influence on people's life. And again, at a time where we have recognized the value of the individual, we want individual consumers in the global south, and we recognize their identities, not only as communities, but as people with needs, with ideas, with volition. And so the individual, we live in a way at a time where the global civilization had reached a point where the individual is the center of the attention. So it's and therefore this depth is to be dealt with, in my view.
So that's interesting. It's almost like an argument for AI proliferation, which is very like the reverse of what people usually talk about in the context of nuclear proliferation. What do you make of arguments that, and I think Nick Bostrom might have an argument along these lines, where over time, as technologies improve, AI in particular improves, becomes cheaper, becomes more flexible, the destructive footprint of malicious actors starts to grow and arguably grows at the rate of this technologies, which is exponential. How does the proliferation gambit play into this in your mind?
It's you're right, it's a problem. The offense will always be and always have the advantage. And therefore, the problem with the software-intermediated society, and then you can enrich software systems with more and more and more complex algorithmic processing and correlations, is that, there is a strategic advantage given to malicious actors. And indeed, we need to deal with that. And that's one of the reasons why we need to be careful in how we adopt. We systematically underestimate the cyber risk, systematically. Mm-hmm. And that's one good thing that the military community is there to remind us that, guys, as we delegate more and more critical decisions to IT systems and powered by AI, and as these AI systems are more and more black boxes, we want to be a bit careful, because a black box is a strategic cyber risk. So, I think he's got an argument, and we need to be careful. And that's why this proliferation is potentially risky. And that's why, but again, if people want food on their table and AI is going to deliver amazing productivity gains in crop yield prediction, the risk is high that the adoption will go faster than the cyber risk is, and that we will expose our collective to a strategic risk, because the internet is global, indeed. Mm-hmm. So yes, I don't deny these questions, I don't deny these problems, and that's why we believe that AI governance is a systematically complex system to govern that requires unprecedented effort in collective intelligence to deal with those things and perform in practice this process of reconciliation. Not in a way that is perfect, it will remain dirty. It will remain dirty. People who look for perfect governance, no, it will remain dirty, approximate, partial, but we need to move along that line. Humanity is like that anyways.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that. I think that framings of AI safety that revolve around like perfect safety, or framing of AI governance that revolves around perfect governance, like these are intrinsically doomed to fail, and we're going to end up feeling, and looking stupid if we end up saying, if we try to claim that like this is achievable. Such an underserved area. It's one of these, it's I think by far the most important policy governance challenge we're going to have to address in the coming years. Can you speak a little bit, you've alluded to the partnership, the global partnership on AI. I'd love to hear from you. So what is the global partnership on AI? What role do you play in it? And how do you see it fitting into the framework that you've provided?
Okay, so the partnership on AI was launched last year within the G7 as a result of a leadership effort from the President of France, Emmanuel Macron, and the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, to bring together a series of like-minded countries. And when we say like-minded countries, around these liberal and democratic values, particularly human rights, to try and invent better understanding and practical solutions to adopt AI responsibly for the benefit of humanity. So we feel perfectly aligned with that, and that's why we are very much part of the partnership. I appointed to one committee, which is a data governance working group. I also chair the newly launched Committee on Climate Change and Biodiversity. And the Fuse Society, as a nonprofit, has been retained as a knowledge partner and help the Responsible AI Working Group and the Pandemic Response Subgroup, which is a very important focus of the partnership, devise its strategy for 2021 and identify areas of action and assessing potential initiative and potential priorities. And for us, it's a very important tool. It's a tool that has evolved from the way in which it was envisaged. From 2016 to 2018, we at the Fuse Society did some research, borrowing from theory of regime complex in arms control, in climate change, in international finance and trade, and in internet governance. And we, with others, we're not the only one, but we came up with this idea that we would need an IPCC for AI, an intergovernmental panel for AI, adapted for the intergovernmental panel on climate change. Why? And why now? And why this as the first building block of this governance regime? For the reason which I mentioned before. We are in dire need of bringing around science the global community of experts to help build a solid base of matter of fact as to what is AI, what are its dynamic over space-time, and what are its consequences over space-time. And this IPCC for AI was envisaged as a way to do that, a bit like what was done to understand climate change, its dynamics, and its consequences. And along the way, the idea has evolved in the international negotiation, first bilateral between France and Canada, and then multilateral within G7, to realign the mandate around more of an action tank. I still believe that there is a need for this evidence-based, collating evidence, and I'm trying also to get and see how the partnership could not abandon this very important mission. But I want to state that this important mission of base of matter of fact needs to engage everyone, including China. And GPA being an initiative that brings together like-minded countries around human rights, for example, it cannot include China at this stage. And so we need other forums, probably in the UN, to do this work of an IPCC for AI. Because if we don't do that work, we will not be in a position to bring experts on a common diagnostic. And it's very important for AI safety, but it's also very important to align on the balance between AI ethics and AI and development, if you want. So that's
I think that's just a great summary, and it dovetails very nicely into the next question I was going to ask, which has to do with China. You know, we often frame the dynamic between the U.S. and China as competitive. People use the term arms race a lot. It's unclear. Like, I mean, it's a very complex arms race, obviously, but as you say, like in the context of an IPCC for AI, in the context of the global partnership on AI, that puts China at the margins there, understandably so. But they are a massive AI power, and they're poised to become more so. So what do you think concretely, like what could we do to bring them in the fold at the same time recognizing that historically with things like bioweapons, we know China has disregarded a lot of international law on that. The idea that they'd be reliable partners in this is certainly a big question mark, to say the least. So like, it seems like there's an enforcement piece, and understandably China won't trust us either. I mean, it's a two-way street. So I don't know if these considerations are things that that you've thought about yet. It's obviously early days. Oh.
We not only think about that, we work on that. Just to give you an example of one thing that we did, we organized in Silicon Valley in June of 2018, the first and so far only US-China AI Tech Summit, bringing together business and tech leaders, not government. We envisage this as a 2.0 track diplomacy. Let's bring together business and tech leaders around two things. Can we try and agree around the latest trends in business models and technology development, but in a very applied way? Mm-hmm. And looking at business models, can we recognize that China is a very innovative country? It used to be that Silicon Valley had, in a way, the monopoly in disruptive business models. These days were over already then. So how can we, because these business models are heavily underestimated and undervalued in how they trigger impact on the world. We spend too much time on the technology not enough on business models. It's part of the multi-stakeholder thing. We need industry around the table because we need to understand these business models that bring these machine learning based innovations into impact on our lives. So that's engaging and finding the right form of engagement between China and the US, between China and Europe, between Europe and US is at the center of what we do. And yes, I have a few ideas. The first one is that you're right, and you alluded to that. We should not show any form of candor. There is no need necessary to engage China on everything, and China will not want that because there is a competition. We need to acknowledge the competition. But at the same time, we need to find the not lowest, the highest single common denominator of engagement. Mm-hmm. And we have hopes, and we should have hope for that, and the hopes are derived from what happened in climate change. What made the Paris Accord possible in 2015 was the fact that before this accord, there was an agreement between China and the US, a bilateral agreement between China and the US on climate change. I don't think that that will happen on AI between for a while, but what I'm trying to say is that why that agreement happened, in my view, and it's a multi-factor decision, of course, but one important fact is that China and the Global South beyond China had been part of the IPCC for years. So this common base of matter of fact that could trigger the fact of, guys, there's a problem. We have a common urgency to deal with. We need to react together. This knowledge was created together, and therefore the diagnostic was shared, gave the possibility, which was exploited at an opportune moment, for this deal to happen. And so that's why I take the example of the sky blue. We need at least to share a minimum set of diagnostic over AI definition, dynamics, and consequences with China to identify, according to diplomatic and international negotiation processes, areas when we can collaborate around international security, around AI safety. I think that if we do our job well over the next 15 years, we can identify ways in which to engage. And I think that diplomacy works not too bad. And then governments in the US, in Europe and China, if they are well informed by science, can identify areas of cooperation and what we call confidence building measures. Mm-hmm. Will it be perfect? No. Is it guaranteeing? No. But it's either we start on that pathway or we expose ourselves as humans to indeed a potential risk because the race dynamics is on. And if we accelerate and race towards AGI without thinking carefully about second and third order consequences, it is my opinion that we expose ourselves to strategic risks indeed.
Yeah, I think the importance of embracing imperfect AI governance as a reality is so important and plays into this on so many levels.
And maybe just one more point on that is, and one fear in diplomatic circles, which I think is legitimate and we have to be careful about, is the fear of what we call normalization. Some say that, okay, and particularly in the US, that they don't want to engage China on too many topics because it would normalize many others and they want to draw a line and hold the line. I respect that. My point is, can we create a common base of matter of fact, at least because we share that. We share the air, we share the sky, we share space even. We talk about that. And to be able to see what we agree and what we disagree on and find a way to both hold the line where our polities want to hold the line and engage across that line where we think it is needed. The Soviet Union and the United States of America engaged throughout the Cold War. So we need to find these ways. Draw the boundary, but engineer the pathways to traffic across the boundary.
Yeah, I think this is something that's under-emphasized in general conversations about this for understandable reasons. I think like the average person has a completely understandable and largely legitimate knee-jerk reaction when they think about engaging with China with, you know, Uyghur concentration camps, the way Falun Gong, you know, organ harvesting, political, like all this stuff, it's all legitimate. There is absolutely an analogy you can draw between that and Neville Chamberlain appeasing Nazi Germany. Like there are death camps and that is a fact. But at the same time, when you start talking about the categories of risk that we're discussing here, as you say, I mean, like whether it's climate change, whether it's AI existential risk, this is really like it's an all or nothing play. And the level of pragmatism that's required here, the kinds of moral calculations are so complex. I mean, I don't envy anyone who has to take any stand on this. It is so complicated and difficult to address.
Oh, one more point on that, which is of worry to me. And it speaks to the question of alignment. It's a strange way to look at the problem of alignment. I will take a small tangential for a few seconds, but I think it's important. I worry a lot in the case of China over the paradox, if not the contradiction, between the ideological software, Marxism, socialism, and its translation on the ground, capitalism. So the reconciliation between an ideology that remains Marxian, if not Marxist, and its manifestation in reality, which is at times very wild capitalism, needs to be reconciled. And in many ways, this distance that stretched has been in a way reconciled through technological means and techno-surveillance means, an Orwellian system where technology is used to reconcile or deal with this contradiction in a way that controls the population. And it is clear that the externalities of that paradox resolution are extremely negative in terms of risks, in terms of instabilities. And in a way, we would need it to be better aligned. And that's why it's important to also find ways to have China moving towards the pathway of resolution, meaning moving towards much less control, because that's control outputs short-term problems, exports surveillance technologies, but creates blind spots. When you lie to yourself, the more blind spots, the more strategic risks, and that's a big problem. I would say that's a strategic misalignment, which is dangerous between the ideology and the reality on the ground.
That's its own fascinating topic, and I'm so tempted to go down that rabbit hole because it's such a great observation. I mean, I think a lot of people tend to think of China either as like effectively a purely socialistic Marxist state or an effectively capitalist authoritarian.
And the right to, and Chinese want privacy. We tend to oversimplify Chinese beliefs and Chinese views. You know, 1 billion people, we tend to say that Chinese don't need and don't want privacy. I think that's totally false. That's gross. That's disrespectful to them. I think that they have preferences in terms of ethics. They have great people who work on AI ethics. One problem is that we envision, I think with a degree of reality, a control of the state over which how these ideas are translated in reality, that is problematic. But it's not because there are these problems that we should oversimplify projections of preferences of the Chinese people. They are way more complex. They are humans, of course, but it's all, they want privacy, they want ethics, they want redistribution, much like us.
Yeah, and then that distinction between the Chinese Communist Party and the people, between the sort of socialist Marxist or authoritarian framework and then the capitalist anything goes, those two things seem to be so important in terms of understanding what's going on. And they do tie into what I think is like, it's a really important question that I think a lot of people, including myself, don't know enough about, which is how are Chinese companies thinking about AI safety? You alluded to the conference you set up. That seems like such an important step. We talked about OpenAI, DeepMind, active AI safety efforts, active AI alignment efforts. What about the Chinese counterparts? What about Baidu, Tencent? What about these companies? How are they thinking about this?
Well, is Facebook active in AI safety?
I guess Facebook AI Research does have, yeah, a fairness initiative.
No, fairness, AI safety. If you were to bring Yann LeCun, I say that because he's French, podcast, and ask him about a human-level intelligence and the value alignment problem.
That's a good point.
I think because he's a very nice guy, he would not discount it, but he would treat it as, hey, guys, let's not worry about overpopulation on Mars, as we have heard others
That's Andrew, say before. Yeah, Andrew Ng's famous line, yeah.
So even in the so-called West, in multinationals, we still have to do some work on that. And that's why, and I address this question from a scientific problem in the sense that I master in my point, Yann LeCun as a scientist. That's why we need to first reconcile and build a bit of scientific consensus on these questions. That's why this is where I would really start. Now, to address your question, I think that much like in the West, there is, and I don't know, I'm not a China expert. I don't claim that I know Baidu, Alibaba, Tencent, Xiaomi, and all the others. But I think that much like in the West, there is strategic underinvestment in these questions of AI governance, particularly in these questions of AI safety, but also in these questions of AI ethics. Look, if there is no pressure from the government, that's why politics matter. If there is no pressure from the government, there won't be any big incentive to work on AI ethics, except for consumer satisfaction, which is a common ground that we have and that we identified back in 2018 in the Silicon Valley or US-China summit. There are common grounds around consumer satisfaction, around robustness, around part safety of the software to deliver the functionality. But if there is no pressure on what is not incentivized by the market, long-term AI safety, AI ethics, I think, yes, we have a problem. So though I'm not a China expert, I would say that, yes, China suffers and the industry suffers from the same problem that we suffer in the West, but probably with the higher degree of issues because of the lack of government's probably sincere involvement to push these issues on the balance sheets.
Well, and as you raise Yan LeCun and Andrew Ng, that really does highlight your earlier point that the technology, sorry, the conversation begins with the science and the technology. We will not make progress until we can get people to agree on what the risks are. And if we have a faction that says, look, there is no risk, like the probability of an existential catastrophe from AI is zero, then that really kind of hampers the conversation.
And vice versa.
Correct.
When we say that AI safety is all that we should care about,
yeah,
and we should try and slow down the pace of AI, you'll have people in India say, oh, sorry, yeah, I need water, I need electricity. So it goes both ways, and it's science at the center, but it goes way beyond science. That's why I think what we need to build is a solid science-based, science-driven, but civic epistemology or a series of civic epistemologies. And that's very hard, of course it's hard. Some would say it's impossible. I would say this is what it takes to build human flourishing over the long run.
Well, and to your earlier point about imperfections, I mean, like it may not be possible to do perfectly, but surely some compromises are possible. My biases certainly were showing there when I was talking about like the one side of the coin, people who just refuse to acknowledge the AI risk. Yeah, I tend to think that there is one. But you're right. I mean, there is this balance between, you know, how big is the risk and how do we meet in the middle with countries like India?
And I don't deny the need for some people to isolate themselves from that conversation and do disentangled research in their own corner at peace. And even, I would venture to say, hide it and hide the result from potentially strategically risky interests, including, for example, defense. So that's why the fact that philanthropy funds, to give you an example, MIRI to conduct research in his own little nook, I think it's very much needed. None of my views are totalizing.
Yeah.
None of my views. I'm just saying that we cannot do only that. Otherwise, we run another risk of misalignment and lack of coordination. But that is very much needed. We need to place different types of bets. But as we place bets, look at what are the trends, what are the exceptions. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that. I think it's a very meta portfolio risk approach and something that, you know, we all have this risk of like becoming very polarized and seeing a certain problem very clearly and then to the exclusion of all others. This seems like a really important approach to it. What do you think the role of governments might be in terms of funding, maybe not necessarily the kind of AI safety research that's being done at MIRI, but like, do you see an appetite there? Are governments open to funding like pure AI safety research, or are they still more focused on economic development?
I think that there is enough money in the government to fund more AI safety research. I think it's in the interest of governments who declare themselves in favor of human flourishing to invest more money there. And at the same time, I know that a lot of these investments are dual and therefore are bound to be seen with suspicion. That's why I see the role of philanthropy there to deal with the duality problem.
Right.
And that's number one. And number two, I think that government need to do, so I'll give you an example. I started the Future Society initially at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government as a student because I went there to create the Future Society and to really learn new skills, new network, and operate from a position of, in a way, influence, because Harvard is quite influential in the world of government. And the Kennedy School is a renowned institution, and the imprint of John F. Kennedy and his vision over technology as a new frontier had a resounding impact on me and potentially was a good message to carry. As part of that, we had at the Kennedy School, the then director of DARPA. We know that DARPA has had an immense effect on techno-scientific pathways of AI and beyond internet, GPS, self-driving cars, so many things. And so one topic of engagement we had across the table was, how can you, in your funding scheme, fund better prediction over the second and third order consequences of your research.
Right.
These externalities, which go way beyond your vision of national security, should in a way apply back to you because you know you have a global impact. So these frameworks of responsible innovation and looking at how do we deal with how do you in your tenders push and internalize part of the third and second, or second and third order consequences have to be done. I think that trying to influence public research around that can be done too. I think it's in everyone's interest, or in most people's interest. That's another pathway through which it can be done. Trying to invite, including through regulation, those who fund and do excellent research to be more reflexive over this research. In the short term, ethics, in the immediate term, development, and in the ultra long term, safety. Yes, there are points where there will be, in a way, inadequacies and orthogonalities over short and long term, but in a lot of areas, it's potentially compatible and has to be explored.
Very interesting. Yeah, I mean, again, that portfolio approach showing up as a theme, it seems like such an interesting and very differentiated strategy too for the Future Society. Just the way that you're doing it, I think it's the geographic aspect of it. Most people do talk about portfolios with different, like, you know, investing in safety along different axes with respect to time, like short-term AI safety, long-term, and so on. It's that geographic piece that really does seem necessary. I mean, there is no way the AI equation works out without some kind of global coordination around this stuff. It's just really cool to see the work you're doing there. Nico, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts. This is a really stimulating conversation. Is there a website you'd like to point people to? I think people really should check out the Future Society.
Well, come and see us. Come and join us. If you have money that you don't use, donate it. Thefuturesociety.org. www.thefuturesociety.org. And thanks a lot, Jeremy, for your invitation. And please keep on the great work you're doing.
My absolute pleasure. I'll provide links to all that as well in the blog post that will come with the podcast. So folks, if you're listening, you can check that out as well. Thank you so much, Nico.